Hello and welcome to this unique episode. I'm Jeremy Strike, coming through the wire. Today, my guest is Andrew Yang, and he is a Democratic presidential candidate for 2020. He's an entrepreneur, lawyer, philanthropist, founder of the Venture for America nonprofit, which focuses on creating jobs in struggling American cities. I think he worked in Baltimore. Yang has experience in startup, early stage growth companies, and the Obama administration selected him as the champion of change, as well as the presidential ambassador for global entrepreneurship. Andrew Yang he's an interesting guy. He has a real personality. He's also the author of Smart People Should Build Things and a more recent book called The War on Normal People, which discusses automation and how it threatens many jobs in the USA and across the world. If you're not familiar with Andrew, his signature policy is universal basic income, which he calls the freedom dividend. And he will tell you better than I in this episode what that means. But this was an interesting conversation that I look forward to hearing your feedback for. You can find him at Andrew Yang on Twitter and at Andrew Yang 2020 on Instagram. I don't know about you, but I want another presidential candidate on the show. So much so that if we make the jump to 50,000 downloads for this episode, I will ride my bike into the Atlantic Ocean in the middle of winter so that we can get them. What does that mean? That means hit that purple little button, subscribe, share, leave a review, leave a rating. It's what keeps this podcast going, and it's what makes it so we can get better and better guests for you. And now, Andrew, yay.
Anitha Bieberg. I'm the CEO of Seva Exchange Corporation. Seva means volunteer in Sanskrit. And our chairman is Edgar Kahn. He invented the concept of time banking. And time banking is where you give an hour of time, you get a time credit, and you can redeem that for an hour of time that you need. So you volunteer at a nonprofit, and now you can get an hour of someone mowing your lawn or reorganizing the garage. Who wants to do those things? No one, right? Well, there actually are people like that. So what we're doing is we're using technology to do skills matching to needs. So using AI, because trust me, you may not like doing something, but there'll be somebody out there that does, right? And wouldn't it be great to, you know, spend more time doing your passions, you know, for free and helping others and getting things you need for yourself? And those people who say, oh, well, I just volunteer for the sake of volunteering, well, then donate those credits to someone else in need. Right? So you're doubling your volunteering impact. So this is why it was so exciting when I read this and I'm like, are you my twin? What the hell, man? I've been planning this too. So
yeah, that's true.
That's I'm not supporting him just because of that, but I mean that was after the fact. So okay, Jeremy Strike. I met him at a blockchain event and I thought he was remarkable that he was interviewing so many people. He has his own podcast, but he just from asking a couple questions, you were so amazing with your interview skills. So I invited him to help us. And I don't know, do I need to introduce you? Andrew Yang, thank you all.
So Andrew, before we get started, a mutual friend of ours told me a story and I want to
clear it up. Oh wow, this will be so fun.
So you were a lawyer for a couple of months, right?
Yeah, 5 months.
So what was the relationship between your law time and Dungeons and Dragons?
Yes. So I went home to my parents after a few months as a lawyer and said, I didn't dream about becoming a scribe when I was a kid. I dreamt about going into the woods and killing something.
Mm-hmm. And now you're going to be the dungeon master.
Well, now I have to go kill the dragon. Unfortunately, the dragon is alive and well.
Andrew, you were an entrepreneur. Yeah, that's what you were born into doing. So how does this transition from entrepreneurial spirit into politics, how does that play?
Well, I certainly wasn't born entrepreneurial necessarily, where my father was a physicist. My parents, how do you went to Berkeley? My parents met at Berkeley in the 60s, and my brother's named after the Lawrence Observatory. We used to joke that he was conceived there, but I'm sure he wasn't. Boring Taiwanese grad students. So my father's a physicist. He has 69 U.S. patents with IBM and GE. My mom's now an artist. And I think one of my mom's high school classmates is here. Same school, schoolmate. So I grew up just as a nerdy Asian kid. Certainly not like, oh, this kid's going to be an entrepreneur. I mean, I didn't have a paper route or any of that. My parents said, do well in school, get a good job. So I went to Exeter and then Brown, where I started economics. And then I went to law school at Columbia and was an unhappy lawyer for 5 months. And at that point, then I left to start a .com. So at that point, I guess you'd consider me entrepreneurial. But that first company totally did not work out. It had its like mini rise and maximum fall during the .com bust. And so after that, I worked at another software company, and then I became the CEO of an education company that grew to become number one in the United States and was acquired by the Washington Post in 2009. So at that point, my parents started telling people about me again. There was a long time they pretended. They pretended I was a lawyer for a while. So when I was the head of this education company, I personally taught the analyst classes at McKinsey, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley. And I saw all of these smart, ambitious young people that really did not like their jobs. And they reminded me of me at Davis Polk. And I was like, what a train wreck. Someone should really do something about that. So then when my company was acquired, I was like, well, what do I think the biggest problems of the world are? And the biggest problem at the time, I thought, was that we had so much talent doing so much stuff that was not really going to push the economy or society forward. And so then I thought, well, what would I want them to do? Because you can't just be a negative dude. You can't be like, oh, don't do that. So I thought, well, what would be the most positive thing that I could imagine these young people doing? People like Jackson, who's now a freshman at Stanford, 3 years from now, when all of his friends are going to go to Silicon Valley companies. So I thought the most wholesome, productive thing they could do would be to start and grow a business in a place like Detroit or New Orleans or Cleveland or Baltimore, places that were not one of the big five or six cities. And so I started this organization, Venture for America. I donated $120,000 to seed the organization. And then I started calling rich friends saying, do you love America? And then the savvy among them were like, what does it mean if I say yes? And then I said, at least $10,000. And then they said, I love America for $10,000. So our budget was around $250,000 in 2011. This year, our budget's more than $6 million, thousands of applicants, hundreds of fellows. There was a documentary made about us by an Oscar-winning filmmaker that's now on Netflix, if you like documentaries. It's called Generation Startup. I make appearances as the magical Asian man who shows up and does good things for people. I have an IMDb credit now as myself. So that's what I've done for the last 7 years as an entrepreneur. And this is a very long-winded way of explaining how the heck I got into politics, that I created Venture for America to try and create jobs in the U.S., because I thought if you had enough jobs, then everything would be good. We've helped create about 3,000 jobs around the U.S. I got medals and awards for that. But I became convinced that we were pouring water into a bathtub that has a giant hole ripped in the bottom, where we were creating 3,000 jobs, and then we're going to lose 3 million jobs at the back. And the reason why Donald Trump won the election in 2016 is that we automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Missouri, all of the swing states he needed to win. And right now we're sitting in the hub of Silicon Valley, and everyone here knows that we're about to do the same thing to workers in retail, call centers, fast food, truck driving, most common job in 29 states. And that what led Donald Trump to become our president is just going to get deeper and more brutal very, very quickly. So imagine if your job was to create American jobs, you realize that what you're doing is not going to come anywhere near solving the problem. And then you think, okay, how would you solve the problem? And there's no realistic way you can solve the problem unless you have an engaged public sector. And so that's when it all started cascading on me, where I said, wow, someone needs to make this happen in the public sector as quickly as possible. And I now, at that point, like many of you, have been around the block enough to know that no one in the existing political system is going to do it. And so that's when I decided to run for president. So I'm certainly not someone who's like a natural politician, though, you know, I'm getting better.
So you, I mean, you mentioned Donald Trump. You know, that's a big reason why a lot of us are here. So, and one of the, hey, it's true. We need change, and this is the man who's going to do it. So you, this is a quote that you said. I hope I don't screw it up. But he, you said Donald Trump is an emblem of the accelerating decline of American society. And I think most of us, if not all, can agree to something like that. And what's very interesting about this whole, you know, what you're proposing is that, you know, you see that Donald Trump, what has happened with Donald Trump, you see the improvements and the decline in these jobs being eradicated, right? And you focus on the people, right? You have built this Venture for America company, and you say it yourself, the people are what made this great. And you want to use that as president of the United States. And so how are you going to do that? How will you empower the common people to, you know, take back control of their jobs and their livelihood?
Yeah, indeed. So it's been said that the opposite of Donald Trump is an Asian guy who likes numbers. And so a lot of what we're doing right now, we pretty much have to do the opposite of. And so right now there's something of a trickle-down economy where there are certain people, including many of us in this room, and it's totally, you know, it's reality. And that the theory is that if certain people do well, then it will somehow trickle down to others. And what we have to do is we have to build a trickle-up economy from human beings and families and communities up. And I go through some of this in my book, where right now financial insecurity is sweeping most of America, where 57% of Americans can't afford an unexpected $500 bill. Many of them are experiencing, like, just week to week, month to month, income volatility and financial insecurity. It's one reason why the work Anita is doing is so important, and that I love time banking so much. So the question is how you can reverse that. And unfortunately, most of the conventional political solutions aren't going to work at all. Like, the most popular liberal solution would be something like, we can educate and retrain Americans for the jobs of the future. And that's like a competent sounding talking point. But then when you dig into the numbers, which I did in my book, and I was very like deeply interested, I was like, how well do government retraining programs actually work? Would you all like to guess how well they work on a percentage basis? 3%, 2%, 5%. Yeah, the range is between 0 and 15%. And fewer than 10% of workers qualify for retraining programs as they're currently structured. So you're literally looking at a solution that might work for like 1% to 2% of workers. And so it's a competent sounding talking point, but it's more or less a complete fantasy. And so the way that you try and put more economic agency and power into people's hands is really just by directly putting cash in their hands. And so the centerpiece of my platform is universal basic income, which I have rechristened the freedom dividend, because Americans just really like the word freedom. It just tests so much better with people. Actually, I take that back. Among progressives, it all tested well. But then conservatives like hate it. And then you have freedom dividend, like it. So being practical, freedom dividend it was. So if you put $1,000 a month into Americans' hands, from the data, you'd see better health and nutrition, higher graduation rates, better mental health, lower domestic violence, lower hospital visits. So you'd make life significantly better for many, many Americans very quickly. And in terms of the economic opportunities, it would create about 4 million new U.S. jobs. Because right now in a main street in the U.S. in Missouri or whatnot, if 57% of people can't afford an unexpected bill, then there's not a whole lot of excess money floating around in that community. So if you put $1,000 into their hands, they're going to spend it on things like car repairs and tutoring for their kid and the occasional night out. And all that money is going to go into the Main Street businesses, they're going to end up hiring people, and they're going to hire people in a way that's accessible to the people in that community.
So you'd say that it empowers entrepreneurial spirit?
Yeah, it would be the greatest catalyst to entrepreneurship and creativity we've ever seen because, and this is something we all know, most entrepreneurs have a mindset of abundance, of possibility, of optimism. It's like, okay, if I do this, I can make this work and I can get that. And that's the opposite of the mindset of scarcity that most Americans are right now occupying. So in my book, I talk about how there's scarcity research where if you were to remind someone about bills they can't pay, their functional IQ goes down by 13 points. And that's one standard deviation. So if it feels like America's getting dumber, more impulsive, less rational, more racist and misogynist, that's what is happening by the numbers, where if you introduce financial insecurity into many, many people, then that's what happens to them. So the only way to reverse that is by something like the Freedom Dividend, which will invert that. Right now, in my view, scarcity is winning in this country about 60-40. And so we can make abundance win by 60-40 with something like the Freedom Dividend.
It's almost like ruling with fear instead of love. Ruling with love instead of fear.
Yeah, and you get their heads up to think about what they can actually do in their communities. Because there's so many people. I mean, I've worked with hundreds, thousands of entrepreneurs, as has Ron John, as has David. Like, and entrepreneurs like are so can-do and like positive. And if you go around much of the country, like I'm a Northeastern product, and I was shocked at how negative and depressed and beleaguered most of the country feels and most of the people feel. When I'll use Detroit as an example, I'm heading there next week. I love Detroit. But Detroit was a city of 1.7 million people that now has a population of 680,000. So you look around and that city is two-thirds empty. And there is no escaping that reality. I mean, there are whole neighborhoods and swaths of the town where it just seems like a bombed out science fiction landscape. And so, you know, expecting people in that community to necessarily have like a mindset of abundance, like, you know, it's not realistic.
So with this, you know, the Freedom Dividend, you've spoken about Alaska, right?
Yes.
So for anyone who doesn't know, Alaska has implemented a similar program and it's been fairly successful, right?
Yeah. So 36 years ago, a Republican governor said, hey, there's a lot of oil in the ground here in Alaska. And who would you rather get the oil money? The government who's just going to screw it up or you, the Alaskan people? So then the Alaskans were like, us. And he was like, I thought you'd say that. and so now if you move to Alaska, even if you move to Alaska, the following year you would get between $1,000 and $2,000, no questions asked. And if you have young kids, they get it too. So now the petroleum dividend is wildly popular in a deep red state, and it's been in effect for 36 years. It's created thousands of jobs, improved children's health, it's lowered income inequality, and it's wildly popular among a bunch of, you know, very Republican Alaskans. And so anyone who thinks that, you know, it's not possible, it's like, well, they've been doing it very successfully. And one question I ask people in Iowa and New Hampshire when I'm traveling is I say, look, Alaska's doing it with oil. What is the oil of the 21st century? I'm going to ask you all the same question. What is the oil of the 21st century? Information,
knowledge.
AI, knowledge, data. Yes. And so that is what we need to do nationwide. And that message is very, very powerful in a lot of the country.
Do you think that's contributing to what you call the greatest technological shift in history?
Well, I mean, other people are in the, like, people here in this room are part of the greatest technological and economic shift in human history and the history of the world. There are other people in other parts of the country that are just on the receiving end, honestly. It's like, I mean, sure, they have like miraculous smartphones and like some great apps, but for the most part, they're on the receiving end of it. And that's one of the things that frustrates me so much is that we keep pretending that things are more or less like they were in like the late 20th century. And David's shaking his head at me like it's crazy, where I tell people, it's like, it frustrates me when someone calls me a futurist, because I'm like, this is like, right, I'm a fucking presentist. It's just that our it's just that our politicians are, no offense to anyone, but like, just like really behind the times. Like, you know, they're like, I mean, they remember the 50s. so I mean, I mean, it's, yeah, in Washington, D.C., I don't know how much time you all have spent there, but Washington, D.C. just feels really, really, retrograde in like 20th century. Like, I'm friendly with like a lot of these legislators, and even a congressman went in there and said, this place feels like ancient Rome, where like you feel like you can't get anything done, and it's got the giant marble columns and everything. If I become president in 2021, one thing I want to do is just to transform like the physical environment of this place. You know what I mean? I mean, we have this dysfunctional Congress. You got to like create like a bullpen and force people to like sit and talk to each other, like force people into different interactions. And it'll take a while to build those buildings, so I probably won't benefit from the upgrades.
How do we work?
Yes, a giant congressional WeWork. Let's bring it in. Because, like, you know, even if you go in trying to make changes, like, the buildings are so old, and it's, like, all this old wood, and it's, like, da-da-da. They should just put, like, you know, it's almost like they're, like, wearing wigs or something that's, like, standing around. Mm-hmm. So you have to upgrade that stuff.
I'm laughing. Laughing because I actually went to school in D.C. and know exactly what you're talking about. It does feel like you're walking around, like, an old mausoleum, right? And there are ways that you can change that, you know, and make it more lively. And one thing that does have the benefit of is... it's mostly young people that live in that city, you know, which is kind of sad in its own way because that means the politicians don't live there. Oh. But it is mostly young people. And I think, you know, when you're president, people will really take to those changes.
Well, thank you. Yeah, let's do it. Yeah.
So we'd be remiss to not ask you about the blockchain here in Silicon Valley. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I was going to talk about it here. I got to say, like, there's no blockchain passing these lips in Iowa. I'm not, like, busting out the blockchain there. So big picture, the market, and this is one reason, again, why Anita and I are super aligned. So the market does not recognize many, many things that are core to the human experience. And I'm a parent. I'm going to get all our parents. Raise your hands, your kids. Yeah. So I've got two boys, 6 and 3, one of whom is autistic. And there are many, many things that the market does not care about, including child rearing and nurturing, caregiving, volunteering in the community, the environment to a large extent, arts and creativity very often. Increasingly journalism in a lot of towns around the country. Journalism has like zero market reward. And so right now, a lot of these things are losing in American life, and we're spending less time on them. Americans even socialize like at least 25% less than they did in earlier days. And so right now, if we just keep following the market, we're going to end up zeroing out many of these activities over time progressively. And so the goal to me is that we modernize our measurement of economic growth, where GDP is something we invented almost 100 years ago during the Great Depression when things were going to shit, and the government was like, we need a number for this. And then so this guy, Simon Kuznets, came up with GDP, and he said at the time three things. One, we should never use this as a measurement for national well-being because it's really bad for that. Number two, we should include parenthood and motherhood because they add immense value. Then the number three, we should not include national defense spending because it actually adds no economic value. So, of course, we ignored all those things. like GDP. And so now, almost 100 years later, we need to upgrade our visions of economic growth to include human-centered measurements. So you all are brilliant people who are making the future happen. So how would you all measure the economy if you had to just do so from scratch today? Like, there's none of this GDP thing, and you're just like, hey,
happiness quotient, like Bhutan.
That's happiness.
Expectancy.
Quality adjusted life expectancy. And if you did that, you'd see our life expectancy has declined for the last 2 years, which is shocking in a developed country. Mental health, freedom from substance abuse. If we did that, we'd see 8 Americans are dying of drugs every hour. Also shocking.
Do you think that's an indicator of something larger in the society?
Oh, very much so. I mean, you go out to these places. So when you get rid of a factory, and I've spent 7 years now working in the Midwest and the South, when you get rid of factories, those communities go dark red very quickly. Like, they become very conservative. And right now they're doing a lot of drugs. I mean, there's like a lot of darkness. There's a plague. So if we were to upgrade the measurements of economic growth to be things like childhood success rates or environmental sustainability, then you end up creating a whole new range of activities that people could do. So maybe right now, there are 3.5 million truck drivers in this country. It's the most common job in 29 states. 94% male, average age 49. And so then the question is, if here in Silicon Valley, the people are confident that we're going to automate away a significant proportion of those 3.5 million jobs, because there's $168 billion in economic rewards per year for automating freight, then you have to imagine, what will the new activities be for that population? And right now the market will say, like, well, we don't really have much need for like a former truck driver like went back in our community. But if you create an economy where if that person helps their neighbor, yeah, it's your favorite, right? Helps the neighbor, gives someone a ride, like coaches a little bit, moves some things around, maybe like install some solar panels, like any of these things, then it doesn't need to be a 9-to-5. But they can add enough value where they end up having meaningful engagement with the economy. So we need to evolve to the next stage of capitalism. And we have to stop following GDP and capital efficiency off a cliff, because more and more Americans will have less and less of a place in that in our current economy.
So would you say these markers like GDP and, you know, the declining, I think the... employment rate, or not the employment rate, but the rate of
labor force participation
declined by 3 or 4%.
Yeah, which is enormous. I mean, you talk about like each percentage point leaving the labor force is like 2.5 million adults dropping out. So right now, as we're here together, the labor force participation rate in the United States is 62.9%, which is a multi-decade low. Much, much lower than other industrialized countries, and the same level as El Salvador and the Dominican Republic. That's right now in year 10 of an expansion, where things ought to be going well. So you have already this mass of unskilled men getting pushed out of the workforce. And men and women deal with idleness differently. Women, you deal with idleness just fine, turns out. it's like you find very wholesome, positive things to do, and like the home, community, like caregiving, right to school, it's all good. Men, we deal with idleness terribly. 75% of free time spent on the computer. Unemployed men volunteer less than employed men, even though they have much more time. And then they move into drinking a lot, substance abuse, self-destructive behaviors, and a general downward spiral. And that's almost universal for men. And that drives the opiate deaths that we're talking about earlier. So it's all tied together, and we're looking at like a nation-scale, society-wide set of problems, and the solutions that our politicians are suggesting are just going to nibble around the edges. And so we have to go much, much deeper. We have to attack the reasons why Donald Trump won the election. And he's a symptom, but he's not the cause of the disease. Like, people who are focusing on him, to me, are missing the point. It's like all of these other things drove Americans to a point where he became president.
And how will the freedom dividend cure that disease?
So the freedom dividend alone will not cure the disease, sure. Though it will do a whole lot of good, like a whole lot of good. And if you think about and I'm going to go a little bit into the campaign, where Donald Trump's set of solutions was essentially, we're going to freeze time, we're going to turn the clock back, like build a wall, hate immigrants, like generally just like really berserk, ridiculous, nonsense. And so then the other direction is like turn the clock forward, accelerate time and society, like value people intrinsically. $1,000 a month would be transformative for tens of millions of families around the U.S. And then if we were to layer other things on top of it, there are three things that are making Americans miserable in terms of their costs. Number one is housing, which you can all relate to here. Here, though it's worse here than it is in other parts of the country. It's not as crazy here. Number two is healthcare, and then number three is education. And those three things have had massive inflationary pressures over the last number of years, because those markets are completely distorted and dysfunctional. And so we have to go and try and attack each of those pain points and say, look, why is our healthcare system so expensive? Why are we spending twice as much as other countries do, even though we get worse results? It's like, well, let's do something about that. So I'm for single-payer healthcare, government, negotiate the prices much, much lower, and then there'd be a parallel gold-plated system for people who work at the NVIDIAs of the world or whatnot. And so that would be, to me, like an intelligent way to alleviate a lot of what's driving Americans to distraction. Right now, we've overprescribed college generally in this society. And we've stigmatized vocational and apprenticeship and technical work when those jobs are actually some of the hardest to automate. You know, it's like you're going to have a really hard time automating an air conditioning repair person. There's not going to be like the aircon robot being like, hey, I'm like, you're like, you know, I mean, that's really hard. I'm looking at Rajah too. Because that air conditioning system was built at like the, like, you know, like a long time ago. And so the robot's like, you know, I mean, sure, you can make a modern one now. But so we need to destigmatize that entire set of opportunities because there are 15 million unfilled middle skill jobs right now in the US. And then on the flip side, we have $1.5 trillion in college and grad school debt with all these young people getting degrees that don't make any sense. So we need to try and drive more people towards the vast middle and transform the culture really to prioritize and value that sort of work. Because right now, kids think, if I don't go to college, I'm a loser. And then so they think they have to go to college. And that's not right.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up because there's the numbers show that fewer and fewer people are going to universities and colleges, but more people are enrolling in these vocational schools. And if we have that stigma, you know, that creates, you know, a cohort of people that have this, you know, bias, you know, maybe I should have gone to college, but it doesn't need to be that way. So it's interesting. I'm curious, what do you think for your children? Will they be in four-year universities? Will they be paying for
my dream? My dream for my children is that they get into Stanford and then drop out after 1 year. That is the height.
Yes.
Yes. I've only budgeted for 1 year of tuition. After that, you're on your own, son.
But truthfully though, I mean, in, you know, as technology progresses and whatnot, do you think education will change? Do you think, you know, the freedom dividend would change the way that we go about educating our young people?
Well, I think the freedom dividend would make it much, much more attractive for many people to not necessarily attend college, truthfully, because like if you could maybe pool your money with like a few friends and like start a small business or whatnot, that would become much, much more realistic for many, many Americans. And that's what we should be doing in a lot of these small towns around the country. Because a lot of these small towns, too, are emptying out. And there are so many trends that horrified me when I wrote this book. If you read the book, how many of you read the book? I mean, a bunch of you have. So if you read the book, you're like, wow, there's a lot of really depressing shit in this book. And you should know, that was the experience I had writing it. I was like, oh man, that number is crazy. Like, there's so many crazy numbers in this book. You're like, that can't be right. And you're like, so some of the numbers that horrified me, 40% of American children today born to an unmarried mother, which I found shocking. Americans move across state lines at lower levels than they have in decades. Americans start businesses at lower levels than they have in decades, where there's one stat that I don't think made it into the book, where literally 80% of the new businesses in the U.S. are started in one of 20 counties. Not 20% of counties, 20 counties. It's like that dynamism is that concentrated in a small set of areas. And that's the way it felt when I went to a lot of these other parts of the country, where you go to other parts of the country and there are a lot of businesses closing and not a whole lot of businesses opening.
So how will you convey to these, you know, maybe it's truck drivers in Illinois, how will you convey that this is the truth? Because they're not really seeing it firsthand. You know, they don't have Silicon Valley.
Well, you know, what's interesting, guys, so I've now been to Iowa 5 times, New Hampshire 4 times. And so when I go, and there's a video of me speaking to 1,000 Iowans online right now that, you know, gives you a sense of it. And what I say to them is like, hey, have you noticed stores closing in your main streets, in your areas? And they all say yes. And then I ask them, why do you think that is? And then they all say Amazon, which is right. And then I say, yes, is that going to get worse or better? And they were like, worse. So they know it. There's no like mystery. And then I say, well, what are you going to do about it? And then they say, well, what can we do about it? And I say, I tell you what you can do about it. You can make me president. And I will bring each of you $1,000 instead of it all just getting whisked off to Seattle. And then you can rebuild your Main Street economy. I would bring $16 billion a year here to the people of Iowa and create 40,000 jobs here in Iowa. Like, let's do something about it. And that message is very, very powerful. And it's working. Where I'm going to break down some of the mechanics of the election. It's so fun. So we have this very, very messed up political system in this country, as most of you know. And most of the arteries, the pipes are clogged with money. Like, when you get there and it's like, it's all just institutionalized. But then, like a good science fiction movie, there's like a porthole to like a vulnerability where you like climb through the porthole and then you wind up in Iowa. No, it's true. And then you wind up in these like these little like union halls and homes and cornfields, and there are 3.1 million people in Iowa. What percentage of them do you think participated in the Democratic caucus in 2016? What percent?
4%.
4. 10. Half.
2.7.
Between 5 and 6%. And the reason for that is that caucusing in Iowa is a multi-hour commitment. It's not like, oh, like a little booth, like pull a booth and like get out of there. You stand there. And you have to publicly say, I'm supporting Andrew Yang. And then you argue with your neighbors, you stand in different parts of the room, and then if your candidate's not viable, you get like reassigned, being like, hey, your candidate doesn't have enough people, so pick a new candidate. And then they reorganize, and they debate after every reorganization, and the whole thing takes a couple of hours. It's also dead winter in Iowa. And Iowa, it turns out, is right next to Minnesota. It's actually quite cold. So 170,000 Iowans participated in 2016 in this process. So let's say this cycle, a lot of enthusiasm, it goes up to 200,000. Now, most of you know that the Democratic field is going to be very, very crowded this time. Let's call it 20 candidates. So how many of the 200,000 Iowans do I need to win in order to win Iowa?
5.001%.
Oh, really? It might be that low, but like we're estimating, if I were to win 20%, I win Iowa easily. Like you might win with like 15%. So you're looking at winning literally 30,000 Iowans. And then that would be enough to make me like number one, two, or three in Iowa, and would make me like national headlines, like all this momentum. And I'm telling you, I've been there 5 times and I can get 30 to 40,000 Iowans to own this reality. Like, I don't. Anyone who wants to join me in Iowa, I'll be back there November 16th. So if anyone wants to come to Iowa City, it's a delightful college town. You can come on out. Did you just raise your hand? You want to come to Iowa with everybody? It's not as cool now as it's going to be. All right, let's go to questions. Ava. Yes. So one of my fondest hopes is that if you imagine an America where people are getting $1,000 a month, that it will encourage many more communal living arrangements where people will come together and say, hey, the five of us get together, we can like fix up that old farmhouse and then live together. I think it will fuel a real movement towards minimalism, personally, because there are going to be many more Americans who want to live simply in a way that doesn't like cost them a lot of money. Like there are a lot of people I know who feel stuck in New York who might like be like, hey, I'm now actually kind of excited to go to Vermont or someplace cheaper. But I do think climate change is an existential threat to our society on the same scale as the automation of jobs. To me, the automation of jobs is coming quicker and nastier, but not by much, because climate change is like right there behind it. And so one of my big hopes, at this point, I'm very negative on this, the sense that like even if we were to be very aggressive about our own carbon emissions, the U.S. is less than 20% of global emissions. And at this point, we're probably at a point where the Earth's going to warm, the sea levels are going to rise, even if we were to get more aggressive about our own emissions. So I would certainly resubscribe to the Paris Accords, but I would get much more aggressive and invest in geoengineering and mitigation and resilience. So to me, we should be investing hundreds of billions of dollars on our infrastructure, trying to make it more resilient. We should restrict any insurance from building in places that are hurricane prone and flood prone that we know are just going to have problems over the years. And we should invest billions and billions on doing things like, apparently the way glaciers melt is that warm water hits their base and then they melt over time. So if you were to pile up a bunch of dirt at the base of that glacier, you might be able to preserve that glacier for an extra series of decades. And so we have to start piling some dirt at the bases of glaciers. I'm even for various mechanical solutions. Like, this is going to sound very science fiction-y and dumb, but I'm for mirrored satellites, where you just like mount them up and then it's like kind of the little Mr. Burns style. But as long as it's mechanical, you can undo it. You don't like it, you'd be like, hey, let's take that thing down. The thing down, like put it up on an, you know, in like an elevator. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah.
And even things that are as simple as recycling, there's a direct correlation with the amount that people recycle and the median salary in a location.
So you're saying that if we got more people in the money into people's hands, because one of my concerns, if you put more money into people's hands, that they might like consume more and have a higher like carbon footprint. But I think that would be somewhat balanced out in some ways. But like, we need to go very aggressively towards this. And one way, if you were to measure economic progress and include sustainability as part of the measurement, then you might be able to get millions of Americans doing things like installing solar panels and recycling.
Mm-hmm. How about putting a price on carbon on your basic income?
Yes, I'm all for it. I should have included that. Thank you. I'm all for a carbon tax and dividend. One of my favorite things in the world is trying to get companies to internalize the cost of what they're doing. So I think we should fine gun manufacturers for any gun death that's caused. And then that would motivate them to say, hey, you know what? Maybe I should like try and not have guns get in the hands of people that are going to use them to kill people. They'd also invest in things like signature guns and technologies that would like make it so that they're less dangerous. I love internalizing costs because I was an econ guy. And like, if a company is going to benefit itself from a negative externality that affects the rest of us, then that ends up fueling really perverse corporate behaviors. So we have to bring that money back. And the carbon dividend, a tax and dividends are a great way to do that.
We're charging $1 million per bullet.
Yeah. I mean, if you charge $1 million per death, I mean, that would be a game changer. And that's my starting point, is like, if your gun kills someone like in a public setting, then you'd get charged $1 million. Drew.
Yeah. One of the results of having Trump as a president is that the racist underbelly of the United States has been unmasked.
Yes.
You earlier called yourself the magical agent, but to much of America, you are the scary agent. How are you going to deal with that?
You know, what's been interesting for me is Iowa's about 94% white. New Hampshire is 92, pretty similar. And if you're in an environment that's that predominantly white, the level of racial animus or hostility is very, very low, because they don't actually have any like insecurities about it. Part of it is that I do not need to convince everyone in those states. I just need to convince the Democrats. And the level of racial hostility I've gotten from the Democrats in those places has been essentially zero. Now, if I get to a point where I become the nominee, then it becomes much, much hairier. But I will say that I'm already getting a bunch of Trump voters supporting my campaign. And they'll say things to me personally. They'll say, I supported Donald Trump. I'll support you too. And the things they like about me are that I'm an outsider. I'm trying to shake things up. Like, I don't seem, I'm like a crony. And the fact that I want to give everyone money makes me makes me seem really like anti-institutional in a way that a lot of Trump supporters really, really like. So political alignment in the U.S. is like a horseshoe where the ends start touching each other again. So there are a lot of Americans who really liked Bernie and Trump, as an example. And I'm falling into the same camp, where there are people on the extremes that like me, and that includes a lot of Trump voters.
Yeah, I think that's because you are actually a human. You know? Like, yeah, right? Like, although we're talking about automation, so who knows? But, I mean, in all honesty, though, like...
How do you know?
Andrew, how are you going to fund us a freedom dividend?
Yes. So the main way to fund it, so that the you guys will appreciate this. So the trap we're in right now is that the big winners from AI and new technologies are going to be the biggest tech companies who are great at avoiding taxes. No offense to anyone.
Yes, Apple.
So So Amazon's thing is like, we didn't make any money this quarter. Like, no, I kept telling myself. Alphabet's thing is, it all went through Ireland. Like, nothing to see here. And so the problem is that these innovations are going to soak up more and more work, and the public's not going to see very much of it. So what we need to do as a country is we need to join every other industrialized economy and have a value-added tax, which would then give the public a tiny slice of every Google search and Amazon transaction. And because our economy now is so massive, it's up to $19 trillion, up $4 trillion in the last 10 years, a value-added tax at even half the European level would generate almost $1 trillion in new revenue. And then that money would end up going back into the tech companies anyway, eventually, and like everyone else, because putting money into Americans' hands would grow the consumer economy by about 12%. Then we get back $500 billion of that in new taxes and revenue. We'd spend much less on things like healthcare, incarceration, homelessness services that we spend about $1 trillion on. And we could get back about 600 of the 800 billion we currently spend on welfare programs. So those things together would be enough to fund the freedom dividend. A lot is, we have 126 welfare programs right now, and we could clean up a lot of that. Because a lot of those programs, unfortunately, have really perverse incentives tied in, where if you start to flourish, then you get less. And the darkest version of that is disability, where literally you're afraid to volunteer because if someone identifies you as healthy, then you don't get your disability payments anymore. So right now, the rate at which Americans get off of long-term disability is literally 0%. No one ever just wakes up and says, I feel better today. You know, I'm going to go to work. I don't need this anymore. 0%. And so if you were to go to those people, and there are millions of them now, there are more Americans now on disability than work in construction. Because of the manufacturing workers, the 4 million manufacturing workers that lost their jobs in the Midwest, half of them left the workforce never to be heard from again. And of the half that left the workforce, half of them filed for disability. And so right now there are millions of Americans on disability. And how many of them would actually feel better if you said, hey, you're going to get the money regardless? Probably a lot of them, you know, unfortunately.
So what's the response? So some comments might say, well, the prices will just increase to reflect the $1,000 that's been given to each person. So net-net, they're the same. So what's the official response?
So I commented earlier that the real causes of inflation in the U.S. have been in housing, education, or healthcare. If you look at consumer goods, prices have actually been fairly not inflationary, around things like media for sure, food, electronics, cars. They're either getting a lot better and staying the same price. And so if you put $1,000 into Americans' hands, they'd still be very, very price sensitive and budget conscious. And there'd still be a lot of competition between firms. So unless you have like a quasi-monopoly in a place, one of the examples I use is like, let's say I give everyone in a town in Missouri $1,000 extra a month, which I want to do. Mm-hmm. And then some burger joint's like, ooh, I'm going to like raise the price of my burgers from like $5 to like $8 because everyone has $1,000 more. And the person's still going to go in and be like, wait, why's your burger $8? And then as long as there's another burger joint somewhere in town, then someone will be like, I'm going to go to that one. And so there'll still be competition between firms. Like, you're not going to be able to capture all that money.
What's interesting also about that is, you know, like, American, so I also studied econ, right? So like the US dollar it's a power currency, right? So if you were just to give, you know, $12,000 a year to people, if all the goods were increased in price in America, it would splay out throughout the whole entire world, right? And that's just not, you know, that's not a realistic concept.
We're living in a moment of infinite quantitative easing. And certain people don't want to lose elections.
Quantitative easing. That's an econ term that we won't go into.
Oh yeah, sure thing.
Okay, if you put the money in people's hands, let them do the work and whatever they try to do, it will be probably like old economy. But I feel that you have good vision for new economy. How do you like guide people into the new economy with those money?
Yes. So one of the things that you all very, very instinctively get is that I love progress, I love innovation, and the rest of it. It's just we need to have bridges forward for many, many people. And I agree with you that many people, you put $1,000 in their hands, that it would be going into businesses that are not meant to be like competitive with the Amazons of the world. So the stat I cited earlier about how Americans aren't moving very much is that the hope is that you could spur increased mobility, where if you live in a small town in Missouri and you're getting this $1,000, then like maybe moving to St. Louis or Kansas City becomes more appealing, and then you end up participating more in the global economy. That a lot of these small towns and truck stops, frankly, won't have any economic reason to exist. And the hope is that you can get a lot of people to move and leave. But it's difficult in America to say like, hey, it's time to, you know, we're going to like just have you all move. So the hope is that the Freedom Dividend would enable mobility out of a lot of these communities for many, many people. Because right now, most of them don't have the financial wherewithal to move. And to the extent they have any assets, it's a house that they're underwater on. It's like the vision of the human-centered economy and the trickle-up economy. We have a different vision, hopefully, that people will get excited about. Ramin, since you hosted, you deserve a question, brother.
Just one question. I mean, I just thank you for your sincerity and your integrity. You've never said anything online or in person where I thought you were full of shit, pandering. And I've never been able to say that about anyone running for political office. I mean, I'm talking like city council. So thank you for that. Thank you for making this choice. And that's really my deepest curiosity is, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this for us, for yourself? Why are you doing this?
Thanks, Robin. It means a lot coming from you. I had an incredible journey starting Venture for America over the last 7 years. And much of it was invigorating, inspiring. On the flip side, much of it was really terrifying, where you would be in the rooms with, like, I met, you know, 3 of the last 4 presidents and like a lot of the senators and a lot of the governors. And I was like, wow, like, these people are not that awesome for the most part. Ah, and then you're just like, wow, it's like, if these are the people in charge, like, it's not great. It's not a great scene. And then when I began to feel so strongly about, like, the threats that we're facing from really, just an economic transformation that our society is not able to get its arms around, and I'd been around enough to know, again, like, no one else is going to do anything about it, that I thought to myself, and this has been wrong before, but it's like, if I were to bust my ass and put everything I had in the line and just, you know, like, strain my family and put everything I had into it, like, do I have a chance to meaningfully address the greatest problems of this age, to alleviate poverty, to build a more humane and human-centered economy? It's like, yeah, I think I have that chance. Like, it's not, you know, like an 80% chance, but it's a chance, and it's certainly a chance to accelerate the timeline as the downside. Like, I now know I could be the president in 2021. Like, I've seen the path. But if I don't become president, like, will I meaningfully push society forward? And it felt like, yes, I would. And then when you feel that, then you really feel like an obligation to put your heart and soul into it.
What's interesting, too, is, you know, you've talked about how you get to... you know, go about this with a different playbook, so to speak, right? Not being the traditional politician. And do you think that will play into your favor, you know, tackling these different issues from an alternative perspective?
You know, I really do, because if you look at the numbers right now, about 28% of Americans identify as Democrats, 23% as Republicans, and 44% as independents, which is probably a lot of you in this room. So there's this huge hunger for a third perspective. And someone called me the shuffler because a lot of what I'm talking about, a lot of independents and conservatives would like, including universal basic income, which has a very deep libertarian heritage. And if you talk to conservatives and libertarians, what they hate is the government making decisions. What they like is individual autonomy and agency. So they like the freedom dividend. But right now, the problem is that the extremities are controlling the political conversation. Because of the bipolarity of the party system. So the hope is that I can reshuffle. I can, right now I'm running as a Democrat, you guys didn't know, but I'm running as a Democrat. Hopefully we can drag the Democratic Party in a particular direction and empower the middle, empower the independent silent majority.
it's reminiscent of, so one of the Silicon Valley acolytes is, you know, Bucky Filler, Buckminster Filler. And he talks about, he has this great quote where he's like, you don't bring in change by fighting reality. You bring in change by creating a new model that renders the rest of it obsolete. And that's the kind of changes that you're putting forth.
That's what I'm going for. Thank you, Jeremy. That's all right. So for those of you who want to become a part of the campaign, we would love to have you. So I just want to shout out to Ranjan, David, Brian, and other people who have maxed out to the campaign or come close to doing so. And the maximum is only $2,700 directly to the campaign. I mean, it's like, you know, so affordable for so many of you. So if you would like to join them in that, my staffer, Matt, where are you at, Matt? Is over there. And if you donate tonight, we will give you a signed copy of my book. We have a stash in the back. Now, you don't need to back.
Here.
You don't need to max out. If you donate anything, we'll give you a book until we run out. But I just want to thank Anita, Adam, Ranjan, Raman, and everyone else for bringing us all together tonight. Yes, let's show our fellow citizens what's still possible. Thank you all very much.
Where do you want to sign it?
I'll sign over here in the...